My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
Our next guest is one of the country's greatest music producers and has worked with global artists. Yet a trip to Afghanistan changed his life and outlook forever. We speak childhood, domestic violence, Take That, Spice Girls, and his thoughts on why music is so important. Episode 38, Elliot Kennedy. This is Declassified.
What year was you born?
1969.
In Sheffield?
29th of March, 1969, Sheffield, yeah.
Yeah. What was it like growing up? Do you remember much?
I do. Classic Yorkshire family. We had a caravette. We used to go to Chapel St Leonard's, at the, or I refer to now as Chapel St Leonard, the yeah. English Riviera.
Yeah, yeah.
It was Yorkshire family. You know, my dad was Irish and hardworking, and but I don't remember much of it because we emigrated to Australia when I was nearly four, so I was 3 years old.
Mm.
I do remember the journey. We went on a ship called the Britannis, 6 weeks it took to get to Australia. And I remember being that age thinking, I live here now on this ship.
Really?
Because it was just so long. I couldn't, you know what I mean? I didn't have the concept of it ending ever. So I just thought my mum and dad had just decided to live on a ship.
Yeah, why did they go?
I think there was an opportunity. We were like one of those 15 quid families. You either went to Canada or Australia. So they were trying to obviously populate the countries. And there was a deal where you got to Australia and they gave you a... you lived in a hostel. It was like an apartment block for free. I think you had 6 months to get a job, raise enough money to get a deposit or something.
Mm.
And so we did that. We lived in this hostel, made a load of friends on the boat. You know, Dad met his mates that he ended up starting a band with and doing gigs, you know, the equivalent of working men's clubs. I remember living in the hostel, but then very quickly remember moving into this rented house, and that was it. That was our life in Australia.
What did your mum do for a living?
Well, my dad started originally as a prison warden because that's what he'd done in the army. He was a prison warden in Germany for Rudolf Hess at Spandau Prison. He was the British representative. They used to take it in turns, Russia, America and Britain, guarding him. He was the only prisoner left in the prison. So I think that he just carried on as a prison warden when he got there because he knew how to do it. And eventually started a business as a carpet guy, fitting. And I don't know if he taught himself. I'm not quite sure how that happened. I do remember two of the boys from AC/DC working for him at weekends fitting carpets.
Is that
an Australian band, like AC/DC.
That's genuine.
Straight yeah. Honestly, yeah. I know.
Did you not hear name job.
But then, started early for me. Though.
Yeah, and then your mum.
Mum worked at Polygram Records for a while on the switchboard, which is a bit like that patch bay there. And then ended up working for a paint company most of the rest of the time in Australia.
Yeah. And was it still working class then growing up in Australia?
It was, but it was very different. It was a land of opportunity. It literally was. You could have... I mean, we went from living in a little house in Gleedless in Sheffield to eventually they were able to afford this big bungalow. We had a swimming pool and... You know what I mean? It's like if you were prepared to work hard, you could achieve anything in Australia. Total pioneering times. I mean, it's still, you know, not a very old country. And when we were there, it felt like it was still being built almost. It felt like the whole country was a building site.
Mm.
It was very odd. But they had to work 7 days a week, so we didn't really see that much of them because they were working so hard.
When you said, what was it just you or was it brother and sister?
No, me and my brother and my sister, although my brother was 9 years older than me, and he left quite early. He came back to England to do an apprenticeship as a printer.
Hmm.
So I didn't really get to know my brother. I didn't know him that well. My sister was 7 years older than me, so it was really me and her and mum and dad for most of the time.
Hmm. I mean, it sounds idyllic, right? It sounds amazing to be out there and being so free. Let me rephrase it. Was it always happy?
No, not at all. It was, as a kid, I mean, growing up there was magic. because you were outdoors all the time. So from the part of my life of being at school and being with my friends and stuff, on skateboards or surfing or whatever, growing up like that, being near a beach, going to watch the football, you know, rugby game, was just fantastic. But my dad was an alcoholic. He was Irish, you know, Catholic, hard-working guy. Good Lord, you wouldn't find a more, you know. I got my work ethic from my dad, which is great. And he was an incredible dad, and he worked all hours for us and gave us whatever he could. But unfortunately, he was a drinker, and he was violent. So, sadly, a lot of my childhood memories were pretty violent. Dad being drunk and beating my mum up, you know. So there was a lot of that going on.
Was always drink involved?
Yeah, it was always drink. If he didn't drink, he was the absolute... And you hear this all the time with alcoholics, the nicest bloke in the world, as people will say, you know, do anything for you. It's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's real.
Yeah.
And he was a great guy, a lot of friends, because he was a good man and he was intelligent and he was fun to be around. But unfortunately, when people drink, some people get soft and daft, other people get violent, and unfortunately... He was one of them.
I had to pinpoint it, but was there reasons why he drank?
I just think he was, you know, he was a boxer in the army, so he was a natural. He was Irish, you know. It's not a racist thing, that it's real. You know what I mean? Yeah. He was one of those. He was a slugger, you know, and he'd have a drink and he'd get a bit feisty. And the problem was, my mum, being a tough Yorkshire woman, wouldn't let him get away with it, and she'd give him as good as he got, and they were just toxic. Their relationship was toxic, so. It always ended up in violence. You know, if he went out for a drink, came back, at some point my mum would kick off at him for being out all day. And the problem is, it's hot. You drink alcohol, we all know that that's not a good combination. And that was it, really. That was my home life. Not 100% of the time, but more than half of it.
Did you ever feel scared then, especially as a little one?
Do you know what? I was scared, but I was more conscious of trying to calm him down than anything, because I got really good at getting him out of his anger. Because when he was angry, he was just, you know, he'd kick off and he'd beat my mum up. And the police would come and he'd get arrested. It was just a routine. So all the police knew who he was. But eventually, he'd calm down and he was a good guy and the police would be cool with him because he wasn't a nutcase. He wasn't like a psychopath. He was just a drunk, you know, and he'd get violent. It was not like he was a, like, you know, I ever thought he was going to kill anyone. He was just, I don't know. It was like back in that day when two guys could get drunk and have a fight. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Nowadays, it's not like that. There's probably a knife involved and someone ends up getting killed. It was a sort of a weird period where that was just part of life. It seemed like that. I was always embarrassed by it because kids at school would talk about, God, did everyone see all the police cars going up our road? And I would just keep quiet because they were at my house, you know. And I'd never invite friends overnight for that reason, because I just think it would kick off, you know, and I was always worried about that.
I'm not going to go too much into trauma and whatever, but it is traumatic as a little one, especially seeing violence. What kind of violence was it? Slapping?
No. He would beat her up. There'd be broken bones.
Fists. Was he a big man?
He was a boxer.
Yeah.
I mean, in my later life, I had to put him on his arse a couple of times, and it took the best I had. And I'm 6'6", you know. And he was a 6-foot man, Irish, tough as, you know, nails. So, you know, and if he'd opened up on my mum, he'd do her a lot of damage. There was always, you know, broken ribs and all kinds of stuff. It's pretty horrific. But you know what? I kind of got good at calming him down and got really good at it as life went on. So I'd try to avoid as much of the violence, and I'd sort of take him aside and we'd go for a walk or whatever. But when I was younger, I didn't have that ability. I didn't have that toolbox. So you just do what you're good at, you know, as a kid, and sort of try and make light of it and try and talk him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what? He'd come in from the pub late at night.
Yeah. And mum, he'd have been out all day. He'd have been working. He'd have gone straight to the pub from work, and he'd come back hammered. And mum would kick off at him, and it'd end up in violence. So, you know, I'd either just go and try and hide somewhere, but most of the time, try and stop him from doing it, and try and protect my mum.
Yeah.
And try and get in the middle of it, and try and calm him down, and make light of it, or whatever. You know, you do what you do. But I remember, you know, as an adult, I wanted to sort of make sure that my kids weren't going to have. So you'd send you one of two ways. You can either see that as my dad did it, so it's all right, or you know it's wrong, and this is not going to be the case when I've got kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Thankfully, I took that pathway, and my kids are my best mates. We have a fantastic relationship.
We'll get on to parenting in a little while. Why did you come back to the UK?
So we were out there for till I was about 11, coming up to 12, and my mum had her mother, my grandma, come out for the last year. I think to sort of help her, really, because she was, and I guess it was, she was a best friend, they were inseparable. And my nan wanted to come back home, and we were home for about 3 weeks, and she died, so my nan wanted to come home to die.
Mm.
And we bought a house, we were about to move into it, so we were at my nan's house, and she died the weekend we were about to move out, so it was all a bit traumatic, and we moved into our house in North Anston, a little town outside Sheffield here. And mum just couldn't cope with it. Mum did not deal with her mum dying very well at all. And my dad was a bit AWOL because he was just adjusting to life back here and, you know, into his old routines and all the rest of it. So we had 6 months where my mum slowly lost her nuts and, you know, which wasn't my mum anymore. She was trying to kill herself and it was like one thing after another. So it was a horrific year. Being 12 years old was the year I remember. It was probably the toughest year of my life, and which eventually led to her being sectioned and put in a psyche ward.
In what way did she go downhill?
I noticed the behaviour first when she would just start. She would be telling a story about her childhood, and it went from being funny to being like, "That's not even funny," and then sort of realising she was just becoming crazy in the eyes of a 12-year-old was just like, what's happening to mum? And then she would just be in sort of these delirious moods where she would be talking about stuff when she was a kid or whatever, thing, random memories. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't really understand. I just thought she must be losing her mind. This is what, when people say they're going crazy, this is what it must be. But then I remember coming home from work, from school, and she was scratching herself with her nails. She was just doing this.
On her face,
yeah. So me and my sister found these mittens and put them on her hands and sort of taped them up so she couldn't get them off. And she was just doing this to try to stop us from getting these mittens on. And I do remember thinking, this is just wrong. I'm sure I shouldn't be dealing with this. You know, as a 12-year-old kid, like, having this sort of moment where it's like, this is just nuts, you know, that I'm having to do this.
Was you caring for your mum?
Me and my sister were caring for my mum.
Did she have the ability to feed you and clothe you?
No, me and my sister would probably do that, make dinner. My dad would make food when he was around, so he'd make tea. And it was just very difficult to sort of pin down what was going on around that time. And then coupled with that, sort of nightmare of a time where mum was being misdiagnosed and she was on, they'd probably give her Valium or whatever to calm her down so she wouldn't be all right. Dad had a heart attack, you know, and needed triple bypass surgery. And then I remember one time him coming back from the doctors being diagnosed, he had to have a triple bypass surgery, and sort of watched him go up and take some tablets, and then another 5 minutes later it takes some more. And I remember sitting there thinking, I would have been about 13 by this point, thinking, what is he doing? I said, what are you doing? And he just put his hand up to his mouth. He basically took an overdose in front of me until I clocked what was going on and sort of looked at him, and he just vomited, just sat there and vomited. And everyone was, what's going on? I said, he's just taken an overdose. I've just watched him do it. So we call that, like, that was a nightmare. It was a horrible, horrible time of my life.
So chaotic.
So chaotic.
Who was working at this point?
So my brother was not living at home at this point. My sister was working.
And bringing in money for the family?
Yeah, my dad was working as a shop blaster, so he was just getting a working class income. My mum wasn't working. So we were close to broke, you know. We had nothing in the house. We had no, you know, there was nothing. We barely got by, you know, and nearly lost the house. I'm sure we were broke most of the time. So then Dad had to go on just benefits because he was recuperating from a triple bypass. And he was obviously clearly going through a depression as a result of that and not being able to cope with not being the guy he was. He was this, you know, vigorous guy of, you know, a big, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so yeah, strong man.
Yeah, but yeah, strong man. So all of a sudden he was, you know, he was just recovering from a troubled bypass, and then mum was in the psyche ward. It was a tough time, mate. It was a tough time.
So what happened then? How did she get sectioned?
Well, after about 6 months, clearly the doctors who would come and see her realised it wasn't helping and whatever, and she needed to be going to hospital. So, and that was it. Once she went into hospital, we lost her completely. It's almost like she just disappeared. And I would go to see her after school, and she had no idea who I was, and it was pretty horrific that time. And Dad would take us to go and see her, but not all the time, because he was sort of AWOL at the same time and having his own issues.
Still getting pissed.
Still getting pissed when he was not meant to be, because he was recovering from, you know, surgery. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty dark time, I'll be honest. There was a couple of years there. It was pretty horrific, 12 to 14.
Was there any explanation to why your mum, especially because I'm just picking up on what you were saying about her talking about childhood. Yeah, sorry, mate.
Sorry.
When she was talking about childhood a lot.
Yeah.
When she was in a kind of, like, I suppose, delirious state. Yeah. Did you ever figure out why she'd kind of gone down it? Obviously, the stuff with your dad, but...
She would talk about... She came from a big family, a lot of brothers and sisters, my mum. So her sister, Brenda, was always close to her, and she lived in Sheffield. But during that time, we'd only just come back from Australia. In fact, Brenda and Lol were still in Australia, because they'd moved... Two of her sisters, one moved to Australia, to Sydney, and one to Adelaide. So she would see him from time to time in Australia, but not very often. So when she came back, she'd still got two or three of her brothers were still alive at that point. But they weren't really involved. I think that she kept it away from them all, really. And then they sort of rallied around. I remember it taking about a year before they really diagnosed her properly and found medication that worked with her. And then it was great, because she sort of came back and she had this cool sense of humour, and it's almost like a lot of the stress and things that were really getting a day would disappear because the medications that made it go away. And they diagnosed her with a sort of nervous disposition, so she had an injection every month. If she missed it, I could see like the doctor was 2 days late or whatever, she would get the sort of shaking. She wouldn't be sort of, you know, where she like she was before, but I'd notice it in her behaviour, and the nurse would come and give her, and she was absolutely fine again, and she was back to herself, and everything was got better very quickly. Dad still had the odd, you know, Larry, you know, session. He'd go out and get hammered, and there was still not as much violence, but and so things were sort of better for a few years after that. You know, they got. You know, Dad was still able to work. He got a job in a carpet place where he was selling carpets. He had fitters, and, you know, he got healthy again. And he was, listen, this guy had 8 heart attacks in his life.
Holy shit.
And just nothing would keep him down. He'd have a heart attack, and in a hospital, he'd come out of the hospital, and the next day he'd be mowing the lawn. You know, he was a machine of a man.
Was you embarrassed about your mum being in hospital?
Yeah, I didn't talk about it at all. I never told anyone at school any of that stuff.
Yeah.
But music was my thing, you see. Music was my escape from it all. Through all of that time, I was writing songs. Anyone who knows me at school knows me as Elliot. He was that guy that was always at the piano, you know, in school. Every break time, every lunch time, I would avoid going home and staying at school until I was kicked out by the cleaners. Because I'd just be at the piano.
Because you wanted to be there.
Yeah, I just wanted to be enveloped in music. And by the time I got to being 15 in my first year of sixth form, I didn't really want to leave school because I was able to make music there. And we'd done a project that allowed us to put on a gig and allowed us to buy some equipment. And there's a Porter studio and a synth and a drum machine, and I spent my whole year of sixth form making an album. I just didn't go to any lessons. I'd with the intention of going to lessons, but I'd go in at 8:30 in the morning. I thought, just go and have a listen to what I did yesterday. And look at my watch, and it was 4:30. Oh, no. I've done it again.
Yeah.
So the very last day of school was the most profound bit of advice I've ever been given. The last day of school, my first year of sixth form, I was mixing my album because I knew it was summer holidays. I'd not get a chance. And so everyone's losing their, you know, losing it because it's the last day of school. And I've got my headphones on backstage mixing onto a cassette deck. And the headmaster, Mr. Forster, who was quite an imposing man, came and said to me, "Can I have a listen?" And I sort of gave him the headphones and sort of listening to the track, you know. And he said, "What are you doing?" You know, so I'm just finishing an album, you know. He said, "So what are you going to do next year, Elliot?" I said, "Well, I'll come back and finish my A-levels." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "What do you mean, why?" And he said, "Elliot, you're lucky." He says, "You know what you want to do." He says, "These kids don't know what they want to do." He says, "What are you waiting for? You know exactly what you want to do." So I walked out of school that day and didn't come back. And that's probably the best bit of advice I've ever been given. So much so that a few years ago I did a gig at my school to raise some funds for... one of the teachers that was there was going to have a commemorative garden, so I raised some funds to do it. Put on a gig, went and did all my hits and stuff. And I found him and invited him. And I gave him a Spice Girls Platinum album, that award thing, you know. And got him up on stage and said, "Unless you told me, on this stage..." It was the same stage.
Was it?
I said, "We were stood over there and I was mixing my album. You said, 'What are you doing? Why don't you leave and get on with it?' I said, 'Had you not given me this device, all this music would never be in the world.' I said, 'And this wouldn't have been a, you know, 22 million selling album.'" And I ordered to him and he started crying.
Just guidance and mentorship, so important. You know,
I just think seeing through it and having the confidence. I mean, a head teacher telling a kid to leave school is mental.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a head teacher. He was a mentor at that point, saying, "You know what you want." He saw it in me, you know. Number of times I've spoken at schools and universities and colleges to say, "Look, I'm a 25-year-old music industry veteran that have had global success with multiple artists, and I'm not academic. I don't know how to read music. I don't know how to write music. It looks like a foreign language to me." So be careful not to let me slip through the cracks if you see me in your class, because my headmaster saw it somehow and said, "Get on with it, get out there." That was the best bit of advice. So,
was you a good kid?
I was a good kid, yeah. I wasn't in trouble or anything like that. I wasn't violent, none of that. Quite the opposite. I was quite a pacifist. I would always stop people from fighting, I think, because that was what I did at home, you know.
You was good at doing that.
And I was 6 foot when I was... So no one really wanted to mess with me. So I never got into fights, really. Do you know what I mean? Even when I was like 13 years old, I was 6 foot tall. So I just seemed to bypass that part of my life, really. And I think I always say to people about, if you're a musician and you end up doing music as your life, you miss out on certain points of your life. You miss out on the BMX years. So when all my mates were out on the street with a BMX bike or whatever, I was in my bedroom learning my instrument. I was playing with synthesizers or playing bass guitar or whatever, writing songs. And then the next phase you miss out on is the going out with the lads phase, because you're in your band, in rehearsal rooms, doing gigs at working men's clubs, earning a living, you know. So you end up being a bit of a loner and all your friends are musicians, which had a profound effect on me when I went to Camp Bastion for that reason, that I'd never really experienced that level of camaraderie, that brotherhood thing, other than just being in a band, but on such a massive level. Was a life change. It literally changed my life and my attitude.
Again, we'll get there, but before we move, how did you go from some sound advice to being at Wimpy, or was that before?
So, I realised I needed to earn some money.
Yeah.
So by the time I was 15, 16, I could get a job. And by that point, what happened, the very last year I was in school, we were in a competition called TSB Rock School, which we did really well, and we came third in the country. And it gave me confidence as a songwriter, although I did almost punch Timmy Mallett, who was one of the judges and acting a bit of a dick. So that was an interesting episode.
That's
a name drop.
They get better, I promise you.
So we did that competition. I remember thinking, do you know what? I could probably do this as a songwriter. Never really enjoyed being in a band because I'd never really wanted to be an artist, but didn't quite know how not to do that. Do you know what I mean? Now, what a songwriter or a producer did, I mean? That role I wasn't clear on.
The craft, the trade.
Yeah. So I just thought you just had to be in a band if you want to be in music business. So I started work at the Wimpy just so I had a job and could earn my own money. And then got a job at the studio where we did our demo for that competition. The guy called me randomly and said, you look like you're pretty adept in a studio. And I said, well, yeah, I've got a Porter studio and you'll do all my demos and stuff. And he says, well, we're moving into the city centre. Do you want to come and maybe be a T-boy and learn and stuff? So I'd just grab that with two hands. And what he would do, I'd work at the Wimpy, come down to the studio, T-boy on a session, and tape what was referred to as tape hopping, which is basically just being a runaround and, you know, making studio function. And then once the session had finished, he'd just give me the keys. So I'd stay overnight at the studio, work through until 6 o'clock in the morning, get a couple of hours sleep, and go back to the Wimpy. And I did that for like a couple of years, it felt like. And then once I knew how to use the equipment, I was able to leave the Wimpy and start the studio full time. Except the day that it was about to happen, I was going to go in and gladly hand me notice in. He said, look, my missus is going to have a baby and I need all the extra work. Unfortunately, I can't take you on. I was devastated. So I had to go back into the Wimpy again and think, oh, I'm going to be here forever. But I ended up having a bit of an argument with a trainee manager that I'd played upon in training. He got the worst of me, unfortunately, one morning. I decked him and decided, right, I'm out. And I literally went into a Thomas Cook and got a ticket to go to Spain and went that night.
Why did you go to Spain?
It's the only place I knew other than Australia, because I'd been there the year before with my girlfriend. And landed in Spain at 8 o'clock in the morning. At 4 o'clock in the morning in Girona with a guitar. I couldn't really play that well. And thought, what am I going to do now? And sweet talked this rep into giving me a lift to the coast, to Lloret de Mar, which I'd been to. And I was walking, I thought, I'll go down to the beach and wait for a few hours, and then I'll just go and try and get a job somewhere. So as I was walking down the road, there was one person on the road walking up towards me, and it was the guy who was the rep on my holiday the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw me and he went, big guy, what are you doing here? And I went, I've come to get a job. And he went, well, you look like shit. Here's my key to my apartment. Go and get some sleep. I'll come and... He was from Newcastle, as you can probably tell.
Yeah. It was something like a Cockney out there.
Yeah, it was a Cockney. I'll come and wait out and get your job. And I literally did that. And got a job as a bouncer in a nightclub.
And that
was fine, because there's, you know... And then one day, we had an altercation with some Moroccans who had stolen this girl's purse. And Billy, my friend, was a kickbox champion. He was the other guy. Took care of these guys in front of us. And I was walking home at 5 o'clock that morning and got hit with a baseball bat and three Moroccans in the middle of the night.
Oh, my God.
But do you know what? It was interesting because he teaches you how to look after yourself. Billy taught me how to look after myself. I ended up staying there and didn't come back. I just stayed in Spain and worked the season and played guitar and had an amazing time.
Mm.
And then woke up one morning on the beach next to Bill and thought, if I don't leave now, I'm going to be here forever. So I went home that day.
Why did you think you'd be there forever?
It was just too easy. Living there was... I mean, I was 17, 18 years old. I had a great job, a great get alone, an apartment, a motorbike, and a fantastic gig.
Mm.
And it was just too easy, and I could have done it forever. And I just thought, I've got to get back to being a musician.
So working hard.
Yeah, and I wanted a career as a songwriter. So I came back home and just got straight back into it. Thankfully, by that point, I was able to go back to the studio, and that was it then, and started writing songs, and eventually worked with someone who else could write songs, and that led us to having a hit and one thing after another.
When you got back, there was a time when you'd hurt your dad.
Yeah.
And Do you think that was just?
It was, I was about 20, I was making an album, and living at my brother's house. I moved in with my brother and his wife. They'd got a little, their firstborn at the time, Luke. And I didn't know my brother very well, so he said, why don't you come and stay with us, you know, come and move in. So I did, and it was brilliant, actually. I had a great year. I had a lot of money because I was making records, you know. I'd got no overheads, really. I was paying my brother's rent, you know. So I was able to help them out with debts and things like that and paying things off, and it was nice to be a part of my brother's life. And then I was at the studio making an album, and my sister called and said, my dad's beat my mum up, but he's put a knife to her throat and broken a hand with a snooker cue.
Holy shit.
And I thought, do you know what? I remember I was on autopilot, actually. I remember thinking, do you know what? Enough's enough. I can't do this. I'm 19. I'm 20 years. I can't do this anymore. If this is it, this is it. And I actually thought I was going to go and kill him, I'll be honest. I was actually quite afraid how calm I was. I called my brother and said, I'm going to go and take care of my dad because he's hurt my mum. And my brother, who'd always had run-ins with my dad as well, but he'd moved out. He'd got his family in. Do you know what I mean? He'd got out of there because he just realised he couldn't deal with it anymore. Calmly drove over to my mum's house where the police were, and I could see there was a cut on her neck where he put the knife to her neck, and he just got her arm bandaged up. Broke her hand. And so I said to the cops, I know where he is. He'll be at that pub he goes down to in Dunnington. Are you going to go and arrest him? And they said, no, we can't. This is a domestic. We can't. I said, well, look, I'm going to go down there now. And he went, no, you better not do that. I said, well, I'm telling you I'm going to do it. So go and arrest him or I might kill him, I said to this copper. No, you better not do it. You'll get yourself in trouble. I said, fine. I told you where I'm going. You can't tell me I didn't. It's on the record. I was very calm. It was worrying. My brother turned up. And we got in the mic, came with me, got in my car. And I remember getting to the pub, taking my watch off very calmly, putting it on the side. And this is weird for me because I'm not a violent person in any stretch of the imagination. I've never started a fight or anything. The only time I've ever stopped someone and like ended up hitting someone who was hitting another girl, because that I don't tolerate. I just don't have that at all. This is the only time I remember ever getting involved in something.
Yeah.
And but I walked into this pub and there was my dad at the bar, and I said, hey, we can do this here in front of your friends, or you can come outside. And he acted like, oh, my sons have come to have a drink with me, but then broke the glass and went for me with it. And my brother intervened, and we ended up in a scuffle, and then I just absolutely pasted the life out of him. And he started going into a heart attack. And I thought, I've killed him. And the police turned up and they came in, you know, and his friends were there. I ended up taking a couple of his mates out because I wanted to get back at him, you know, and pounding him, you know, which I felt bad about because I know they were only...
Was you riled up then? Was the adrenaline pumping then?
Adrenaline was pumping, but I wasn't out of control. I knew exactly what I was doing. And I said to these guys, get out of my way. And they didn't, so they all went down in the process. But I got to my dad again and carried on pounding on him. And I just thought, you know, this is it. I can't. If this is the way it is, it has to stop here today. And in all kinds of ways, it kind of did, because the police came and I said to the copper, I did tell you. The police, the ambulance came, took him away, and I said to my brother, "Do you think we killed him?" And Russ said, "I don't know." So we went to the hospital, and they wouldn't let us in. They just said, "Are you his sons?" I said, "Yeah, you're not allowed in." I said, "Look, I just want to know if he's alive." "Oh, you haven't killed him, you know." "Not yet." I said, fine. So I went back and I said to my mum, let him back in and I'll never speak to you again because I can't do this anymore.
Oh, you give her, that's quite a brutal ultimatum.
Yeah, and of course she did. He came out of hospital and I didn't speak to them for ages. And then eventually one day it got the better of me. And I thought, time's too short. This is just not who I am. I've got to have peace in my heart, you know? So I went round and said, and my dad was in the garden, you know, mowing the lawn, and mum saw me pull up. And I just went up to my dad and hugged him. But I said to him, touch her again and I will kill you. I said, but she's watching us through the window, so hug me back. That was a moment between me and my dad, and he knew I was serious.
Was it love, though? Did you do it for love?
He cried.
Did he cry? Did you do it for love?
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
I said, but listen, trust me, do it again, and I will come and kill you.
Was he ever, apart from the work ethic, was he ever a role model to you?
100% role model. When he wasn't drinking, he was a loving father, attentive. He never hurt us, never, ever raised his hand. Most I ever remember is him, if he was angry at me, he was raising his voice, you know.
Mm.
He was not like that at all. It was drink was the demon thing for him, you know. It literally changed him. But then, like I said, I got really good at being the mediator. So this was a really weird scenario. There hadn't been any violence for ages.
Yeah.
They'd argue still. And he'd kick off and there'd be sort of, you know, it'd be a loud argument. You know what I mean? But this was a weird incident. But it had to end. You know, it was like, come on, we're all adults now. It had to end. And it did. It never happened again. Never happened again.
What's your relationship with alcohol now?
I don't actually drink that much. Not that because I'm against it or anything. I'm a bit of a softy if I have too much to drink. But I just get all cuddly and daft, you know. And don't get me wrong, I love having a drink. If I'm not driving, I'll have a few Jack Daniels or a few beers. I'm actually rubbish at it, so I could never drink that much. I was never, like I said, I was never one of the lads, you see. I never went through that, where you build up a resistance to it. So a couple of pints in and I just can't handle it, you know.
Mm.
And I always used to amuse my friends when they'd say, do you want a pint? And I'd say, no, I'm not thirsty anymore. And they'd be like, what's that going to do with it? You know, and it was always, I never connected the two. Obviously, as travelling the world and as I have been able to, you have great nights and with artists and you're on tour or whatever and you drink a few. And I enjoy that. I enjoy having a drink. And I've never, thankfully, had an issue where I've locked alcohol to violence or anything, because it's just not part of my life.
Alcohol can control suffering. It can, it's, you know, self-medicate through someone's suffering. But like you said, if you use it to elevate a mood and use it recreationally to in a situation...
You see, I never needed anything control. Like that because I had music.
Mm.
It's hard to explain to people, but it's the queen of my soul. It saved me over, and it's never let me down.
Well, let's go to 93. You set the production company up.
So by that point, I was writing demos, and I was doing really well. I'd learned really well in the studio. I was writing good songs. I paired up with two great songwriters from Sheffield who needed someone to do the production side, the tech side, which is what I'd trained myself to do. So all of a sudden I went from being just sort of demo boy to we were making records, and we got a chance to make a record for Lulu, which charted. And the other side of my job was doing the rock bands at the weekends that I'd gotten really good at. So I'd got an album in the death metal charts the same week as Lulu in the pop charts.
Yeah.
I just got really good at doing those kind of rock records.
Who was that band?
They were called Monolith.
Right.
It was like a number one death metal record. So I got pretty good at being an engineer, a sound engineer, and that sort of has done me well throughout my life. So my training was in old school rock and roll recording, yet I was able to adapt to computers and stuff. So I had a good old pedigree. And then all of a sudden we're making a record. The Lulu record led on to making a record for Take That and producing a record for Take That. And then we wrote a song with Gary Barlow, and Gary and I become really good mates. They'd never worked with someone who was the same age as them. And my two writing partners were much older than me, like twice my age. So I became mates with the band, with the boys, you know, and that led on to working with Gary more often. So we just stayed in touch and we'd write together.
Was that before they got famous, you wrote the songs?
This was just on the edge. So the album I worked with them was Everything Changes, and that had like Pray, and
that big one. Know, so was it Take That and Party?
The second one was Everything Changes.
Yeah.
So just as I met them, that's when the number one started.
Mm.
So Everything Changes was my first number one record. The irony is I always had an ambition of having a number one by the time I was 25, and it went to number one on my 25th birthday.
Mm.
So it was like this, you know, massive party. And that was the beginning of it, really. But I went through a funny old period where I didn't actually feel like I knew what I was doing. I felt, if I'm really honest, I felt a bit of a phony. like I was sort of tricking my way through it. So I'd convinced my manager at the time, I'd just signed to Sony as a writer, got a publishing deal, to buy my mum and dad's house because they wanted to move into a bungalow. They'd got a semi-detached house, but they had an extension on the back of it. So I could put a studio in the extension, and then people could stay over. It was a 3-bedroom house. So I just said to my manager and convinced Sony, if I do this for a year, just let me learn my craft as a songwriter. I really want to know what I'm doing here. And I said, I don't want to work with established artists. Let me work with new artists who haven't got record deals or whatever, so I can get good at it. And the first thing I did was 911, who couldn't get a record deal. So I said, I'll make an album with you. And that led me to pair up with my producer partners, Tim and Mike, who were in Beaconsfield at the time. So I'd send my audio, my videotapes down to them, and they'd finish the record while I got on with the next one.
With a courier?
With a courier, yeah.
Really?
Literally, a courier would pick up 3 ADAT tapes, video. They were VHS videotapes.
Really?
That we record on these machines, and they had the same format. So I'd send them my work, and they would make it sound better and turn it into a record. So we became this team from Sheffield and Beaconsfield.
Yeah.
So we did that, got them a record deal, 9 consecutive hit records.
So 9-1-1 lived with you, did they? Did they live with you, the lads?
They lived with me, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then out of nowhere, the Spice Girls turned up. Another serendipitous meeting. And all of a sudden, they didn't have a record deal, didn't have any money, so they stayed at my house, and we went to fed them pizzas and all kinds of stuff, giving them petrol money. And then it just got too big. All of a sudden, the Spice Girls were changing the world, and Dad was in my little house in Dinnington with my studio. And then this room we're in was a commercial studio called Fon, and it folded as a business. And I came in to see the council and said, look, I need a bigger space. And the woman who run it said, if there was a space in this building that you've worked in, would you be interested? And I knew it was this. I said, absolutely. She went, well, they owe us like 30-odd grand in rent. If you pay that, you can have everything in it. Huh. And there were 2 studios in here. So I just paid them wrote her a cheque.
Was you cash rich then at this point because you'd done the Sony and you'd done a...
By this point, I was getting huge royalty cheques and radio play royalty cheques from PRS for Spice Girls and 911. I was cash rich. So I just literally wrote her a cheque there, and then I went, I'll have it. And literally she gave me the keys, and I had this had a big mixing desk in, a 24-track machine, which I didn't need. So I sold it all and made 20 grand on selling it all. Yeah, I did. So I rang Tim and Mike in Beaconsfield and said, guy, I've just taken over this huge 3-studio complex in Sheffield, the city centre. And Tim said to me, he said, no, at the time there was a cutting lathe, a TV light, and he went, is there enough room for 2 studios? And I went, yeah. And he went, is there enough room for 3 studios there? And I went, yeah. And he went, right, Mike, we're moving to Sheffield. They put their houses on the market that day. And all of a sudden, we were a writing partnership. So Tim and I moved in here to help build it. And we literally built this studio from scratch. We put 3 studios in, sold the cutting lathe, which was a famous cutting lathe for reggae records. All the biggest reggae records were mastered here on that cutting lathe. But we sold it all, literally gutted the place, and it became the Steelworks. Mm-hmm. And we literally hit the ground running and had a song in the charts every month for about 5 years. It was unbelievable.
Did you continue working with the Spice Girls?
So the Spice Girls thing went off. We did I did 3 tracks on that album, and then they did a Pepsi thing, which I did. And then that led on to the next thing I did with Simon Fuller was S Club. Had them here for 6 weeks, wrote the first single, a bunch of others. Number 1, straight out of the box. 5 was the next thing. I wrote When the Lights Go Out, another massive hit. When Spice Girls were number 1 in America, 5 were number 5 same week. 2 hits in the top 5 of America. La La Land. And then that led on to... Gosh, it was just crazy. It was one after the other. Boyzone, another number 1. Blue, another number 1. When you have a number 1 record like that with Everything Changes, you just think, oh, this is never going to happen again. And the next one was Spice Girls, Say You'll Be There, and you just think, oh, this is ridiculous.
It's
never going to happen, yeah. And then the next one was Bring It All Back by S Club, Meet Madonna to number 1. And you're like, all right, this is getting out of hand. So it was like my decision to develop artists was actually the best decision of my life, because that's probably I'm probably the most qualified in this country to develop artists, because that's all I did for like a decade. You know what I mean? One after the other, what, young artists.
What gave you the confidence to do that? Because you said you had like almost imposter syndrome. You went from imposter syndrome to being going, well, I'm fucking confident with this.
Do you know what? You know what Malcolm Gladwell says about the 10,000 hours thing? I did my 10,000 hours in my house with young artists that there was no pressure. Do you know what I mean? There was no, they weren't big artists, so I didn't have that pressure of like, oh, fuck, I need to write a hit. All I had to do was really dig my, and be honest and truthful.
The process.
And I did my 10,000 hours in that process. So I knew what I was doing. By the time I moved into this studio, I knew exactly what to do. I'd go in my room every day, everything. I remember saying to Gaz when we wrote Everything Changes, because he was just knocking them out. I said to him, how do you get into that zone? And he said, El, you just find yourself there and you haven't got time to think about it. And every day you sit down and write a winner. And I got in that zone. Literally everything I was writing was a hit. And it was like, this is unbelievable. And then I remember one day coming in here, Gaz was having a terrible time in the press with Rim and Robbie. So he went to America. And I just got together with him again. I rang him one day and said, I hope you're not listening to this press. And he went, do you know what, El? Of all the people I know in this industry, you're the only one that's called me. He got dropped by his label. Very depressed, in a dark place. And I went, do you know what? If you're ready, I've got an idea for you. And I just thought, this is the best kept secret. No one's going to clock this. I'd have Gaz to help me develop artists. He's no idea what's about to happen here. So I went over to see him and said, look, I'm developing this boy band with Hugh Goldsmith. You remember Hugh? He was the marketing guy for Take That. He's got his own label now on EMI, and he's got these boys that are great. I'm helping him. They're called Blue. Do you want to get involved? And he went, all right. Well, that was, I dragged him back, you see, back in. And we started work with Blue. We wrote Guilty, number one record, and we did three albums over the period with those boys. And that one led to another thing, and we ended up doing it. He went out to America, and I came out to see him in LA to get away from the press, you know. And while we were out there, we got hooked up on this writing camp in upstate New York, and just had the best time ever. And I could see him coming back. I could see him. I was pulling him back, you know.
Confidence.
Yeah.
Mental health.
Mental health, confidence. He was depressed, and I reminded him that music was going to save him. And I said to him something that he told me in later years when I was having a bad time. He said, El, you taught me that we can write our way out because we've got music. We've got this thing people don't have.
Mm.
And that's what he did. And he could probably read that in his book. I think he says this in his book, and he mentions these times where we would say to each other, I'd say to El, we need to put our head down and write our way out of it. And that's what we did. We just got back in and we developed Delta Goodrum from Australia and Lara Fabian and Blue, and we just had hits again. It was just started again throughout the 2000s, and then Take That started again, and that separated us, and I was gutted because I'd moved over to Cheshire. I'd made a life decision that Gaz and I were going to conquer the world, and then Take That started again, and it was.
And so his time went away with them?
Yeah, he went. He just went off.
Why did he? Because are you still good mates now?
He's probably my closest friend, you know.
Mm.
But that wasn't easy. And I didn't want to ever tell him that, because he was back in Take That, and he was back out of the gloom, and he was famous again, having success, writing great songs and being on tour and stuff. And I thought I'd never going to tell him that, you know, he dropped me in it. But he did.
You didn't want to hold him back, you just let him go?
No, I'd never have held him back, no chance. But I was back in the trenches again on my own, you know, having a divorce at the time, and it was a bad time, actually.
Had you had your two kids then?
I'd had my two kids, yeah. Livy was with Wendy, and we didn't get married. Then I married Dee, and we had Jack, and then that marriage broke up. She started seeing someone else and very quickly got into another relationship. And I was in London and the kids were in the north, and I was in the car for 8 hours a weekend because I just refused to let it affect my relationship with them. And it was a tough time because I was devastated I wasn't seeing Jack every day. And it was different with Olivia. We were never together. You know what I mean? Brought Olivia up separately. So I had a different dynamic with Livs. But Jack was there from every day, and We worked it out. I would refuse to let it happen, so I'd still come up and see the kids and keep my relationship with them. And
have you always, always been a good dad, it sounds like it.
Yeah, it's the most important thing in my life, you know, making sure that we have this relationship. They're now 18 and 22 and my best friends. You know, and Livy's able to get through and cut through and talk to me. Like the other day, she gave me a talking to, and she's able to, like, you know, get right to the core of who dad is. But we are, they are my best friends, my closest people.
I met your daughter a couple of nights ago. She's so lovely.
Yeah, such remarkable. Remarkable. She's doing maths in university. She's a very clever girl.
She calls Sheffield the Hollywood of England.
Of course she does. It's probably because of this studio. She grew up in studios, you see. Yeah. So Brian Adams, Gary, their Uncle Gary and Uncle Brian's my kids. Yeah, because they've just grown up with them, you know.
What was the next stage then? So you and Gary had kind of split. And then how did you bring yourself back then, especially with the kids and stuff?
I started writing on other projects and just got myself back. I actually when I went out to Cheshire, I sold the business to Tim and Mike, this business.
Yeah.
And I called them and said, what are you doing with the studio? Because I didn't want to live in London anymore. And they said, we're thinking about packing it in. So I bought it back.
Oh, from the lads from Beaconsfield?
From Tim and Mike, the boys from the Scousers, from Dead or Alive. So I bought the business back, refurbed it, and just thought, I'm moving back home, I'm going back to Sheffield. Bought my house in Sheffield, it was the best thing I ever did. I just thought, I'm just going to do what I did in the first place. So I started again. But by this point, Gary and I would work on the odd project together, and we did some stuff with Peter Kay and had a big hit with that. And then we went and did the record for the Queen's Jubilee. Around the world record. I did X Factor with Gary, you know, sort of as an artist development producer, because they'd never had one of those before, and they'd never had a band win, and I thought I knew why a band had never won. So they hired me and Little Mix won. They were my band.
Oh, really?
So it was brilliant to have that experience. I loved doing X Factor with Gary. And then out of that, we came our Broadway musical. We wrote our first Broadway musical, which is Finding Neverland, which was a hit Broadway musical, has been on tour ever since in America, comes to UK next summer. So that's exciting. And then in between that, I've had success with other artists doing other projects. So while I've been here, I'm still developing new artists. I've got two development artists at the moment, and then we're just in the process of doing a new album with Heather Small, who's the iconic voice of M People. So I'm still busy. I've written a new musical with Gary, which we hope to do with James Corden as a movie. And then I'm writing a brand new musical about, you know, that iconic picture of the men on the girder above the building?
New York.
In New York. I'm writing a musical about those guys, the immigrants that built New York.
Really?
So that's fun, yeah.
You don't get much done, do you?
No, not.
You want a life.
Bit of a layabout.
Yeah, all northern people, bums.
You see, that's my dad's Irish work ethic, that is.
Yeah.
And Gary's exactly the same. We're both northern lads. Alfie Bowe's exactly the same. We've got that. You need to feel like you've got to. I'm sure you're the same. You've got to put a hard day's work in to get paid.
When you come from nothing, you know, when you come from free school dinners and bus passes and all your mates around you have got the best trainers and you haven't and all the rest of it. Do you know what I mean?
I know that. I was that guy, yeah.
Yeah, you have to
it teaches you.
You have to fight for it.
You've got to work hard, and that continues. And I pass that on to my kids. My kids have got a great work.
I think another thing it does teach you, I'm kind of digressing, but just thought of it now, is we kind of have similar backgrounds but not similar upbringings. Our upbringings were different, but you have to keep with people, and that's what I'm just guessing at, getting from you all the time. What you're saying is that you're just getting people around you who you believe in and trust, and who can develop you and you can develop them.
That's
a kind of, all these partnerships are coming together again and again and again.
Yeah.
2012, you went to Afghan.
Yeah.
And we talk about partnerships and teams and collectives and keeping people together. Why did you go for 10 days?
So it was an opportunity with Gary again to go and play for the troops, and it was going to be a TV documentary. ITV were going to make a documentary about it. But the crack was, I had to go out and find musicians in Camp Bastion and audition them and teach them the songs and then put a band together to be the band for Gary to come in and then entertain the troops. So we had a set list that we thought about. A couple of Take That hits, blah, blah, blah. Some other famous song. You know, 500 Miles, of course, because you've got to sing that. And so I went out for 10 days to get the musicians together. No idea how this was going to work, but I wanted to do it. I went out, and the first day I got there, and we were learning about the alarms and what you to do, and, you know, where not to be too far away from your body armor, all that business, and how I can't leave the compound without an armed, you know, soldier with me. And I just wanted to go home. I thought, what am I doing? This is mental. Seeing, you know, helicopters take off and 100 feet in the air firing rockets off. And
really?
Yeah.
The Apache were going
Yeah,
up.
The Apaches, yeah. Shooting off to, you know, and it was like, this is intense. And hearing the, you know, the war, and like, what am I doing here? And people were still getting hurt, and the helicopters were constantly bringing injured back at all times, you know, and ever-present helicopter noise and ever-present smell of engine fuel. And it was just too alien for me. And I remember getting up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet and just, like, couldn't get my head around what was going on in the middle of the night there. It could may as well just been daytime. It was
like a film.
So much
activity. It's like a film, isn't it? When you look back, it's like a film.
And going to eat was stressful with everyone in there with the machine guns and armed, you know, people watching you as you're eating, and just intense, you know. And then something clicked in it. And it was one day I said to this guy who was a guitarist, who was a driver, truck driver. He used to go out over the line every day. And I'd said to him, do you want to come and audition? We've got a little windows around the curfew, you know, to get this done. Just after dinner, we got half an hour. And he went, yeah, okay, I'll try and be there. And I said, well, no. I said, if you want to do it, I need to know you're going to do it, you know. He said, yeah, I'd love to do it. So yeah, I'll definitely try and be there. I thought, what's the deal? And someone tapped me on it. He said, hell, he goes out over the line every day. He doesn't know if he's coming back, mate. So when he says he's going to try and be there, he means it. And it got to my core that it was just, I felt embarrassed. I felt sad and I wanted to cry, but I didn't. And it was like something just turned in me and like, oh my God, this is where we are. So it's not the news anymore. It's not on, it's not a film.
Yeah, it's not a film.
He doesn't know if he's coming back tomorrow. So everything changed, mate. Everything changed in that moment for me. I'd never experienced that level of camaraderie, that brotherhood thing. Like I said, you miss out on it as a musician because you're busy, you know what I mean? You're doing music. And I went back to the media compound that night, and I woke up the next morning and I was a different person. And my guys who looked after me, Matt and Maz, I remember thinking, I remember these guys forever. And they were so much fun, and just that level of good. And then going, they would wind me up, going to ask them into it. One great night, I remember being in there, I was just with those two, and they said to me, Matt said to me, Maz looked like Charles Bronson, the criminal. Just a bald head, a big mustache, but one of the gentlest, funniest guys in the world. And we're sitting there, and Matt says to me, have you clocked the special services guys yet? I said, how would I know? And he went, oh, you can't miss him. 1,000-yard stare, you know. And I went, oh, right. So Matt said, have a look around, see if you think you can see anyone. So, you know, just tuck it into my nose bag, and I look around, and look to my right, and there's a guy looking at me. You know, caught my, you know. So I went, well, I don't know, but there's a dude over there looking at me. And he went, is he still looking at you? So I don't know. So I looked the other way, scanning around. I thought, Jesus Christ, he's still looking at me. And Maz went, oh, that might be, we should be careful here. I said, what do you mean? And Maz went, give it a few minutes. So we carry on talking and eating. And Matt says, is that guy still looking at you? I said, well, I don't want to look, do I? Because he's still looking at me. And he went, just casually look round. So I sort of look around again, casually look back, oh, for fuck's... I said, he's still fucking... And Maz went, right, we should probably get off, Matt. And I went, whoa, 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 what? And he went, well, no, we don't want any trouble with those boys. I went, what is going on here? What the... all of a sudden, out of my periphery, I saw this guy stand up, brick shit out that he was, and start walking over, puts these meat hooks on my shoulders and went, is this the guy you're telling me about?
Yeah.
I said, you absolute bastard. And of course, everyone on every table around us starts laughing because they were saw what was going on. All right. And it was just blissful. Do you know what I mean? I just thought, do you know what? I've never had this. I've never been one of the boys like this. Never been in this situation.
Acceptance as well. It's
yeah, and I didn't feel like a dick because all the time you're walking around, looking at you like, well, the fuck? You know what I mean? He's this musician guy, you know. And
when you get shit, you get love. Like, the more shit you get, the more love.
Yeah, that's when I knew I was in. I remember going on stage to introduce the band and sitting down at my thingy, and the first bunch of lads going, where's Monkey? You know, just you bastards, you know. I thought, oh, yeah, I'm carrying a bit too much timber, you bastards. I just laughed and everyone laughed, and it was just like, this is what it's like to be accepted and to be part of this. And you know, after that, it was a different one. When we played for them, we did the gigs. They couldn't do enough for me because it was like, you've come out here to do this. For 10 days, they've seen me not knowing what I've been doing. And what I've been doing is putting a gig together for them, you know, and doing this. And I felt the same this week, mate, with the competitors.
Yeah.
I felt that again this week because, like, you did that gig for us, you know, putting on the opening gig and all that. Against some serious adversity, I'll be honest. The military aren't the easiest to, you know, persuade to do a gig.
Well,
some
of the military charities can be defensive as well.
Risk averse to the point of distraction, you know. Mm. So it's been a lot of cajoling them to get into this idea that I knew what I was doing and I was going to put this gig on for them. And I felt the same kind of crack, you know. So yesterday at the sitting volleyball, I was in amongst all the guys, and it wasn't like, you know, oh, thanks, mate. It was all piss-taking.
Yeah, brilliant.
It was like, you know, I remember one of the soldiers, the officers coming out, and goes, do you want to come in out? And I went, no, I'm not a VIP kind of person. I'm with my guys here, you know.
You know when you're on, when you go on tour?
Yeah.
Or when you've been on tour and an artist go on tour, mm-hmm. and it can be really isolated. So that when you go on tour, there's some adjustment getting back, but especially connecting back with a loved one or with your kid and things. There is a period of time. Is that similar?
I think so. I think I would liken it to serviceman or woman being away on somewhere, being positioned somewhere away from their family, and coming home because you're in a bubble. And if there was anything about Bastion, it was a bubble. You know, everyone tells me that you're in this sort of false town. If it was a community, and you know, and there were roads, do you know what I mean? It felt like, and everyone
it's simple,
says
it's
the size of Reading or something.
It's a simple lifestyle. You've just got to do these certain things. And I'm thinking, I'm not saying like an operational tour is the same as a music tour. I'm talking about when you come back.
It's not dissimilar, you know, because it's everything's done at military level. You're in trucks, and everything's got to be moved at a certain time. Mm. There's strict guidelines on how this works from a monetary point of view. You're in and out of hotels like military precision, otherwise it doesn't work. So there's a lot of similarities to that lifestyle. And then when you get home, you've got to get out of that bubble. You're not being shipped around anymore. No one's making you dinner for you. Or, do you know what I mean? You're back into that family zone. It does take a bit of time to readjust, no doubt.
Mm. Speaking about families, you do the Catterick Garrison party in the park.
Yeah.
What do you actually do with that?
I put on the entertainment for them, so I bring in artists to perform live and make it a festival, basically, because it's, you know, it's an opportunity for the Catterick's an odd place because the whole town is the garrison, so not unlike Camp Bastion in that way, that all the roads lead to the military. Do you know what I mean? Literally, so they have this big field and we set up a big stage and a PA system. I bring in artists. And we just play music all day and entertain them, and everyone gets drunk, and the families come out. We had 3,000 last year, 5,000 this year. It's brilliant. I get to go and hang out with everyone, and a lot of them know who I am now and what I'm doing there. So I get to have a drink with everyone, have a laugh. It's just a great day out. And I go home exhausted, just feeling brilliant because I know the effect it's had, you know, and all the families are in there together and the kids are running around going nuts, and it's just a fantastic way of getting everyone in that space, not dissimilar to what you experienced this week with the gig.
I was going to leave this to the end, but before we do it, how does music connect? Why is it so powerful?
I always say it's the backstage pass to everybody's soul, because once you're talking about a song, like I say to someone, what's your favourite song and why? What song got to you? What, you know? People feel comfortable talking about the most intimate points of their life because it's a song. This is the song we had our first dance to, or I kissed my wife. This is the song my child was, you know, conceived to. They're happy to share incredible moments, and you all of a sudden transcend to being almost like a doctor. You're a person that you, because you're talking about music, you're not a therapist. It's not this wall between you. It breaks down all the barriers. And then what's even more incredible is if their song is something I've written. And I've had this quite a few times where people come up and go, that song got me through a really tough time or whatever. You know, I can't tell you how that song was important to me in my life. And I just think, well, Kate Bush was that for me. The Hounds of Love got me through that year of 12 to 14. Mm. That was that album that saved my life. I remember going to see Kate Bush when she did all those gigs, you know, in London.
Last year or something.
A couple of years ago, yeah. And it got to the point she was doing Hounds of Love. I was a mess. I couldn't stop crying. And it was just this cathartic experience of, oh, these songs saved my life. And all those memories that we've talked about my younger years, came through, but I was galvanised because I had music. I had Kate Bush's music. Or I had songs to save me, you know.
It's amazing. Before we came on, I told you about Wannabe.
Yeah.
Spice Girls. That's right. That was like as soon as we mentioned Spice Girls, I was like, oh yeah, that's the first time I got drunk to.
I think mine's a bit more credible than Kate Bush.
It is much more credible. But recently, only a couple of weeks ago, you know, I've got things going on, personal life, and Kate Bush came on. Is it Women in Work?
Right, with This Woman's Work.
This Woman's Work, sorry. I had an hour, I cried for an hour.
Yeah.
This listening to lyrics, listening to the way people sing lyrics.
I mean, think about that you can listen to a song and these sound waves that are moving through air go into your brain and it can bring about a biological change. You cry, it changes your frame of mind. Yeah. You might then make a decision based on it. You might call someone. You might make up with your missus. You might. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that powerful. It's so powerful.
I could only cry when I was listening to the song.
Yeah.
And I just put it on loop. I was laid on my bed. Right. Literally, you know, I've got things going on with my mum and stuff.
Right.
And I just had it on loop. Wow. And again and again. And I was like, I wanted to feel like that.
Yeah. And that gave you permission, right?
Yeah. It did.
That
yes.
song.
Yes.
Gave you permission.
Not nothing else.
It,
yeah. It came on randomly on. Yeah. You're absolutely
sought
right.
You out and gave you permission to.
I felt
be
so much better after.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
And I think that when writing songs, what I've learned, I wrote a song. It's a funny story, listen, it's worth telling. It's a bit of a gang moment. This involves Bryan Adams and Hans Zimmer. There's two big clangers. Drop two wangers there. So this starts with my son had just been born. So Brian's in America working on a movie called Spirit, which is an animated story about a horse for DreamWorks.
Oh, yeah.
And the producer is Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's Spielberg's partner. So DreamWorks is DreamWorks SKG. And SKG is Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Geffen.
Right. Oh, right.
They're the three bosses. So Katzenberg is producing this film, and he did all of the other massive ones of their films, DreamWorks movies. So I'm working over, because Jack's just been born, I'm doing the 4 a.m. bottle move, right? So I'm up in my studio in my house working on songs for this film so I could be on the phone to Brian in L.A. time, right? And eventually Brian just says, El, you're going to have to come out here. We've got to get you out here. So Jack was about 6 weeks old. We were all right. We're in a good space. So I go over. They send the plane for me. Right? So I go, talk about La La Land. So I go there, get picked up. By a limo at the airport, takes me straight to Hans Zimmer's studio. I go in, and Brian's there. He looks like he's been dead for a week and dug up again. And I said to him, you look like shit, mate. And he went, El, I'm getting no sleep, bud. We've got to get this film finished. did you watch that clip that I sent you? Now, this is back in the days of dial-up. So it took me 8 hours to get a little wire drawing clip up, you know, so I could look at it. So, Brian, I've been on a plane for 13 hours. What the fuck? He says, all right. He says, look, let's get watch it now. He says, they're coming in 10 minutes to listen. And this was Hans Zimmer and Spielberg, all of the bosses coming in to listen to this song, which we haven't written. So we're in a screening room with a studio set up. So the guy puts the scheme thing up, and it's like a rodeo. It's a bit of the film where the tagline of the film is "Some spirits can't be broken," and it's about the cavalry catching these stallions off the plains and breaking them, turning them into cavalry horses. But this one's not going to be broken. He's throwing them off like, you know, like nobody's business. So it becomes a rodeo all of a sudden. So I just said, what we should write here is like a southern rocker, like a rodeo song. So let's write a song called "Get Off My Back." But like a dude saying to a chick, leave me alone. I want to go out and have fun, you know. So we wrote this song called "Get Off My Back." We just sit there and we write this song. It's like 15 minutes. So the power comes in, and it's like there's like a heat lamp on your neck. It feels like, because they're all there in the back row. And I said to Adams, I said, just fucking sing this thing. I'll sing the harmony in the chorus. We'll just, you know, fudge it through sort of thing. So we're sitting there with our acoustic guitars and our laptops. And we just start rocking this thing. And Adams' voice is ridiculous. And he just nails this vocal through. I sing the harmony in the chorus. It's real stomper. And we get to the end of the song, and we're playing along with the film. It's surreal. And then they all go, awesome, man, that's incredible. Come on, man, let's record it, get it up there, you know. So we record this, boom, boom, boom. Go on another year, right? And the objective, the DVD sells 100 million sales. It was just ridiculous. I get an email from Brian. He says, you should read this. And it's a letter that's been faxed to his fan box thing, you know, fan club. And it's a woman from America, and they're called Kate. And she said, me and my husband, he's from Thailand, we had a son called Chan. And then he was 8 years old, and Chan was diagnosed with leukemia. And we went all around America trying to find a cure, and we couldn't find one. And his father decided we should move back to Bangkok, and he wanted to try alternative medicine. But while we were there, I still took him to Bangkok for his radiation treatment. And one visit, he was in the waiting room of the hospital, and there was a film on, and it was a cartoon about a horse. And it came to a scene where this horse was throwing off the soldiers, and Chan was fixated with this thing, and he loved the song and the fact that the horse was throwing them off. And he says, so I said to the nurse, what's this thing? And he's watching. She says, oh, it's this DVD, it's called Spirit. She says, on the way home, I bought the film, and Chan watched it every day, but he loved this particular part. So we bought him the album so he could have this song, and this is how I know it's Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Adams who wrote this song, Get Off My Back, that Chan used to liken to his disease because he wanted to throw it off. And she says, I'm happy to tell you that that song gave us another year with Chan because he fought harder because he loved it. But the day that he died, he was in bed with his father, and he knew he was about to die, but he said to his dad, don't worry, Daddy, some spirits will never be broken. And I always lose my shit at that point, because at that point you go, what a privilege it is to have this ability. Do you know what I mean? Sorry.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's difficult, because you kind of go, my God, it took us 15 minutes. It was about this pressure to beat this crazy deadline. And that piece of music, the most unlikely song in the world that I've ever written, gives these parents another year with their son, who takes the lyric that no one listens to as the definition of his life at that point. And you just have to hold your hands up. And what I learned then was that I just happened to be lucky to be holding a pencil the day the universe needs to write a song.
You're a big man with a giant heart, mate, and thank you so much. And
I appreciate it, mate.
We'll leave it there.
Yeah, cheers.